Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guests today, back by popular demand, are the NBA's scheduling czars, Evan Wash and Tom Corelli. The full NBA schedule for 2021-22 dropped last week, of course. And per usual, you, the NBA fans, you got some questions, some concerns, some gripes, grievances even. Maybe you don't like how many back-to-backs your team got, or five games in seven nights, or maybe they were snubbed on Christmas Day. How did the league pick those games? How did they make all these decisions? How do they decide who plays on opening night? Is it all just ratings and dollars? Well, a lot, but not entirely. There's a reason for every data point on the schedule. It's a massive, complicated undertaking. No one, of course, explains it better than the folks who put it together. Evan Wash is the NBA's Executive Vice President of Basketball Strategy and Analytics. Tom Corelli is the league's Senior VP of Game Schedule Management. They both do a bunch of stuff for the league, but the schedule is probably the biggest annual undertaking. Always an interesting discussion. Before we get to that, a reminder, please subscribe, rate, and review the Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. We are also on YouTube if you'd actually like to see me and my guests yammering instead of just hearing us yammer. Go to YouTube, search Sports Illustrated Podcasts. That channel has the Crossover Pod as well as the Open Floor NBA Podcast and all the other great SI podcasts. Go check that out. Okay, my conversation with Evan Wash and Tom Corelli is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined again by the czars of the NBA schedule, Evan Wash and Tom Corelli. Gentlemen, welcome back, and especially to you, Tom. Thanks for making time. I know you're on a kind of a pseudo-vacation, and appreciate you guys both taking the time to break down the schedule for us again.
Good to be back.
Absolutely. Tradition unlike any other.
A tradition unlike any other, which, by the way, we are now – we almost lost Tom for this one. Thank you for making the time and for finding your way on – to the Zoom. But this is 3 for 3 now. This is our third one, and all three times you two have not been in the same room. We had me and one of you in the same room and somebody by phone each time. And it's been different each time. Now we're all in different places. This still further underscoring my belief that after you guys finally finish the schedule, you want nothing to do with each other. You can't stand being in the same room.
Well, we never actually set foot in the same room this year to do the schedule. So
we didn't even set foot in the same state.
I don't think so.
the pandemic has claimed much more than our social lives. It's claimed everything. So there's a bunch of stuff to get to here, and I'll just start with this. Actually, we're starting in October and we're ending in June, which seems really normal and great. Were you relieved just to, as the guys who are in charge of doing this and have all the adjustments you had to make on the fly the last 2 years, how relieved just to finally have some sense of normalcy? And I understand we still have a short turnaround, shorter than usual, but this seems like this would have been a lot simpler, at least, than what you've been doing for the last 18 months.
Yeah, I mean, Tom can certainly speak to the process side of this as well and how difficult it's been to work with our teams. But just from a basketball and season perspective, I think it gets lost. The whole reason, or one of the main reasons why we played a 72-game schedule this past season was A, to avoid overlap with the Olympics, both from a fan engagement standpoint, but also to allow players who wanted to participate in the Olympics to do so. But also because we felt it was critically important that we get back on track to our typical October to June window with our 82-game season. And so we cut last season short in order to do that. And we felt that, you know, the late July to late October timeframe was a sufficient break, significantly longer than we had last year. And so, yes, it feels great to get back on track. And the fact that we did four different schedule versions over a 14-month period between the bubble, the first half of the 2021 season, the second half of the 2021 season, and now this coming 21-22 season, it will be especially nice, I think, to go another 10 months without having to do any schedule, knock on wood. But that was the goal, and it's you know, fulfilling and relieving to be there at this point.
Yeah, I was going to echo that and say that it's great relief to be able to be back to what Adam referred to and we've been talking about as our normal cadence of playing in October. Now, it meant that we had a very short track to do this. It's a very short track for turnaround from the end of the finals and the Olympics to the start of the 21-22 season. But this is, you know, this is the window that works best for our game, we feel.
Yeah. So I'm going to crib some notes here from my pal John Schumann over at NBA.com, because he had a great breakdown of some of the just kind of the structural highlights, which I think are much closer to what we're used to in a schedule. So this is from John Schumann. Average of 13.5 back-to-backs per team, down from 15.2 this past season when things were obviously a little bit compressed. And there was a lot of talk about that and whether it had effect on injuries and all that. Evan and I discussed that when he was on the pod a couple months ago. So back down to a normal range of back-to-backs. No four games in five nights. Last season, there were five of those. Only three instances of eight games in 12 nights. That's belonging to the Grizzlies, Spurs, and Blazers. Last season, there were 36 instances of eight and 12. There are an average of 16 instances per team of at least 2 days rest between games. That's up from 10 last season, so that's pretty dramatic. And there are fewer one-game trips. This is not something I don't think we've talked about before, or something that you guys have necessarily focused on, if I recall. But so only 7.1 one-game trips per team this coming season, down from 10 this past season. And that helps result in a mileage reduction where teams are going to average about 43,000 miles per team, which from what I read was a record low for a 32-game season. So how close to normal is all that I just read down? What's new within all of that, and how satisfied are you with where you came out?
So everything sounded accurate, which is a good starting point. all of that reflects the priorities we placed on this season. So obviously last season was unique in both the compression to fit the 72 games in, but then the postponements and rescheduling we had to do. So you mentioned all those four games in five nights last year. We didn't schedule teams for four games in five nights. Those were the result of postponements due to COVID and actually those storms in Texas last year that cost us a few games. In order to reschedule those games and put those into the second half, that necessitated the four games in five nights. And so we've now gone five straight years without scheduling teams for four games in five nights, and rescheduling sometimes forces us there. So that's more business as usual. As you said, the back-to-backs back down to a normal range for a full season for us. The priority was on travel for this year. And I think one of the things we learned from the pandemic season is that things we had to do last year to cut down on flights for various safety reasons, playing consecutive games in close geographic markets. So teams going to LA and playing both the Lakers and Clippers consecutively. Same thing in New York, Chicago, Milwaukee, Golden State and Sacramento, Miami, Orlando, that you can really cut down on travel, both in terms of miles and number of trips, flights, if you combine those road games. And the new element we put in last year, the series, where two teams play two consecutive games in the same market, which also cuts down a flight later in the season. And so we leverage those things to reduce the mileage down to that record low. You mentioned an estimated 43,000 miles per team for this coming season, because there is a sense that that's going to be particularly helpful from a player health and rest perspective. And the last thing I'll add is it's not just the number of two-day breaks that teams have in their schedule. If you think about a standard schedule, teams are playing roughly every other day. And so you could schedule a full season where a team plays every other day, has no back-to-backs, but they'd also never have 2 days off. And a typical NBA team won't practice if they have a game day off and then another game. They're only going to practice in those windows of 2 and 3 days off. And so to build in that, that rest time and that practice time, you need those. And so what we focus on is not just the number, is that the actual spacing, that we don't want teams to be going too long without an instance of those. And last year we had, because of those postponements, we had a couple teams that went the entire second half of the season, which was 67 days long, without a 2 day break. And so they were just playing, you know, game off, game off. And so those patterns were incredibly taxing. We reverted to a normal schedule here and put a heightened focus on making sure that those breaks came at a regular cadence for all teams. And so no teams have anything remotely close to a 67-day stretch without 2 days off. And that was a big focus as well.
I want to hit the mileage thing real quick, just because I didn't see a baseline for this. So if it's an average of 43,000 miles and that's the lowest ever, what is that down from? What has been the most recent high point, or what's the rolling average?
Yeah, so our average, and the had the 1920 season been played to its completion, that, that full season schedule would have been around 46,000 miles. So it was something on the order of an 8% reduction. But an even bigger dent in the number of flights, again, because you're playing consecutive games in markets where there are two teams, or, you know, the series themselves, which cut down those flights. So all in all, we believe a materially reduced travel burden on the teams.
The fact that there's going to be only about 7 1 game trips per team instead of 10 in the 2019-20 season, which was the last full season scheduled that way anyway. Obviously it didn't finish that way. Is that a new efficiency that you guys were focused on, was trying to do fewer of these out and back 1 game trips?
Yeah. I should have touched that as well. That builds on the exact same point about flights. So if you play 41 road games in a season, at the two extremes, you could play 41 one game trips, in which case you would have 82 flights, because for each of those road games, you would fly to the road game and home, and you do it 41 times. That would be 82 flights. You could also play it as one 41 game road trip. You could leave, play your 41 games and come home. And in that case, you'd only have 42 flights, because you'd fly out for the 41 games and home. So teams are going to fly somewhere between 42 and 82 times. The more single game trips you have, the closer you get to that 82 number. And so by reducing from an average of 10 down to an average of 7, we've taken another dent in the number of flights that teams have to take over the course of the season and combine those trips into 2, 3, and 4 gamers. And so all of those elements, the series, the close geographic markets, the single game trip reduction, all of that, you know, creates less time on the road, less flying.
So this is obviously just the latest, you know, referring to the 1 game trips reduction. This is like the latest effort by you guys over the course of years here, finding all these different ways to nip and tuck and stretch and do whatever's possible to kind of lessen the burden on players physically, right? Whether that's fewer flights, whether it's the fewer back-to-backs, whether it's simply, you know, the way games are spaced out. And all of this is toward, I would say, a couple things, and correct me if I'm wrong or if I overstate, but some of this is just about player health, obviously, and injuries. Some of it is potentially to counter load management, and so to make load management seem like it's not necessary anymore. But we still see a lot of load management after years of you guys making these efforts to streamline the schedule. We still see a fair amount of load management. And obviously, guys are still getting hurt. And I know that, you know, there was obviously a vigorous discussion this past season about whether the compressed schedule was leading to more injuries or whether it was just more prominent players who were getting hurt and all that. But this is a tough one. But do you guys, because it's so broad, but Do you have the data and the confidence that everything that you've been doing for the last 5 years to make the schedule more player friendly, health friendly, sleep friendly is actually having the impact that you set out? Are those things matching up? Do we know?
We don't know. I mean, no secret. You mentioned the injury rates from this season. They were high, and they've been high for a number of years. It's hard to draw sort of any year-to-year conclusion because of the unique nature of the past few seasons. You know, we're not seeing injury rates spike necessarily, but we're also not seeing them come down significantly. But there's a lot of outside factors there that it's impossible to tie anything to a specific scheduling metric. I think what we would say about the season is, these are no-brainer improvements to make, right? The NBA has had an 82-game schedule for over 50 years, and we've largely played in the same window. So these have always been elements of the schedule, the density, the travel, and these are no-brainer solutions that if we said to any team or any sports scientist, is it better to have more density or less density? Is it better to have more travel or less travel? Is it better to have more sleep or less sleep? We all know what the answers are to those things. The only reason we weren't able to execute some of these improvements in the past was either because, you know, our computer systems have gotten better at sort of finding paths to do these things, but also because they generally come with trade-offs. And the most obvious trade-off that comes with a lot of this stuff is the business side. And so, for example, one way to reduce the burden of a back-to-back is to have a team play two consecutive games at home, what we call a home-home back-to-back. And there was a historical view that was a challenge from an attendance and gate perspective, that if a team hosted consecutive games on a Tuesday and Wednesday, that they might see a dip in attendance and gate relative to what they would see if those games were more spaced out. But that meant that now the back-to-back was going to have travel in it, because if you can't do a home-home back-to-back, by definition, one or both of those games is on the road. And so looking for those opportunities to challenge some of those business notions, we've found that we can move the needle on a lot of these basketball, travel, player health metrics without undue negative influence on the business side. And that's great. And that's why we've moved the direction we have. But you can't then draw the line and say, well, that has reduced or increased injury at this rate. And so we're trying to get smarter about which of these scheduling elements you know, actually do drive injuries. And so, for example, we, in partnership with IQVIA, our player health research, medical research firm, we published a paper a few years ago that IQVIA had authored that basically dispelled the notion that schedule density in isolation was tied to injuries, that we don't see a higher injury rate in the second night of back-to-backs than we do in other games. And we don't see, you know, higher injury rates based on the number of games played over a certain amount of time. And so there's a lot of other things going on here that can't just be tied to like, oh, that scheduling pattern caused that player's injury, which is too often where people want to go with this. But we generally know the things that are more beneficial to player health, and that's less travel, more sleep, you know, more rest and recovery, of course. And so we're trying to move that direction.
Right. So even if you can't, you know, because so many of these things they're basically unprovable, right? Trying to draw these lines between injury and fatigue, health and less, you know, fewer games in a given span. Like, you can't, this is all really hard stuff to just prove definitively, but intuitively this all sounds right. And it sounds to me like the basic guideline for you guys is do whatever's possible to make the schedule less onerous, you know, irrespective of what the data may or may not tell you or how people might tease out that data. The bottom line is, less burden on the players is probably good for not only player health, but the quality of the game. And even if you can't prove that out in any, you know, scientific way, it seems like the intuitive aspect of that is enough.
Yeah. And well, the reason that it has to be enough now is until we can pinpoint the specific things that come with these trade-offs, you have to do it that way. So for example, we could further significantly reduce back-to-backs. As I said, we could move closer to a world where teams play every other day for most of the season, and we would have far fewer back-to-backs. But you would also, as I said, eliminate almost all instances of teams having 2 or 3 days off between games, which in turn is going to eliminate opportunities to practice. And so we think that that's a net negative, that if all of a sudden, yeah, there were fewer back-to-backs, but teams were never getting the chance to rest for 2 days, teams were never getting the chance to practice, that the player load of that schedule would not be beneficial to us. So same thing on travel and game density. And so until we have science that can pinpoint the specific things that we think lead to injury rate increases, and that the trade-off to reduce those things doesn't create its own new issues. It has to be more general, as you've said, and that's where we are.
Yeah. All right, so let me hit one of the things that came up as I was asking folks on Twitter to weigh in also, and I'll get to a bunch of these later in our conversation. But one of the interesting things was that there was an effort by you guys to move a lot of the national games in the early part of the schedule from TNT Thursday to TNT Tuesday until after the NFL season. And the perception there is that this is an issue of trying to go head to head with the NFL. Is it as simple as that you're better off ratings wise to avoid NFL conflicts when you're in that part of the calendar that overlaps with them? How did you get to this place? And I didn't have the numbers in front of me, so you could tell me how many games were shifted.
Well, basically, you know, we've been talking with, we talk with our TV partners all the time. We talk about scheduling issues. We talk about different things. We added an earlier Saturday night game before Christmas on ABC that we haven't done before because they saw an opportunity where they might be able to get another primetime Saturday night. So we added that. We've been speaking with Turner for a long time about, you know, does it make sense? Because we only do one doubleheader a week in the fall on Turner. And are we better off staying on Thursdays, or are we better off taking an opportunity to try and move to Tuesdays and have less competition? And I think together we decided that was, you know, a good path for us to try and go down and see how that would work out. Now, after we come back in January, then we'll go to our normal Tuesday, Thursday cadence on TNT for the rest of the 2022 part of the season. But yeah, it's been a lot of conversations with them. We think this is a great opportunity for us to grow the ratings.
Is this the first year that you've really been that NFL conscious in how you're scheduling the national broadcasts?
I don't know. They've been around for a long time.
Well, I mean, obviously the NFL has, yes. But is the first, I mean, okay, is it always in mind? Is this always something that you have to factor in general? This is a new wrinkle, but is that always something you guys have to be mindful of in putting out the schedule?
Yeah, I think we're mindful of every competition we're working against, whether it's the World Series in October, whether it's the Masters in April, where we're going to have the last weekend of our season is going to be the weekend of the Masters. We have our TV partners. Both of our TV partners are now partners with the NHL. So that now coming into this season. So that's a wrinkle that we hadn't faced before. So now we've got to work with that. But yes, the NFL, Major League Baseball, the World Series, the Academy Awards, which happens to air on our ABC partner. So we're cognizant of competition everywhere.
All right, so back to the structure of the schedule. I think I got more questions on this issue than any other via Twitter. Fans really seem to love the two-game series. Same two teams, back-to-back nights in the same arena. And you guys scheduled in 23 of these, if I've got this correct, in the same arena this coming season. 10 teams don't have any of these. And it's the Rockets have 5, Clippers and Kings have 4 each, Rockets and Sacramento. Da, da, da. So I don't know where you landed on this past season of how many two-game sets you had, but only 23 for the coming season. And I say only 23 because, as I say, a lot of fans came to me on Twitter with, why not more of these? And so is that about just the limits of tweaking the schedule? Is it about what teams actually liked or wanted or were open to? How did we come down on or get to just 23?
Yeah, so it was not science to get to 23. So what happened was last season, I believe we had something in the order of 60 or just short of that. And we talked closely with our teams and players this offseason about the impact of those series. I would say from a team side, specifically on the basketball side, it was nearly unanimous that they were positive on the impact of those series because, again, cuts down travel, right? So instead of 41 games where you're flying in for that game, now you got a bunch of instances where you're not traveling before a road game. And of course, that offers some benefit to that road team, gets them into a routine in that market. And so it was, again, near unanimously positive. Interestingly, we also even heard from teams that as the home team, in those series that they appreciated the opportunity to play the same consecutive opponent, which we would have thought would be the opposite. You would think that if there's an advantage to the road team, that by definition, it's a disadvantage to the home team. But teams, I think, from a preparation standpoint, from a, especially a playoff team preparing for the strategy of playing the same opponent multiple times in a row, that cadence of either the back-to-back or with a day off between, they just liked it. And so that was all positive. The player feedback was a little more mixed. Interestingly, we heard from some players, particularly as it relates to some of our more attractive so-called markets, that two trips to some of those markets over the course of the season spread out may not be a bad thing. And so they said, sure, I'm fine doing a series, but you know, don't make it to City X without naming names, because I want to go there twice. So that was actually pretty interesting. So where we netted out was that it was definitely something we wanted to continue. The big unknown was what I mentioned earlier, was the team business impact and the fan impact. Because most of last season, we either had limited or no fans in the arena, we didn't really get a feel for how those series would impact attendance and fan interest in those games. And so before going full throttle this season in what we expect to be a more normal season with full arenas, we wanted to do a bit more of a pilot test to say, what will happen when Team X visits Team Y for two consecutive games? Will that impact attendance? Will that impact gate for those games? Before deciding how to proceed in future years. And so what we did was we basically took out a constraint that used to be in our scheduling optimization model. We used to put a constraint in that says you cannot play two consecutive games against the same team in the same place because we didn't have series. We forced it last year. Now we said, do what you will. If you find some interesting paths or beneficial paths to do it, great. Don't force it and let's see where it nets out. And so we netted out, you know, with about half of the number we had last year in total and spread across teams. Some teams, as you said, have zero, some teams have more. And where we focused the computer was on the ones that offered the most travel benefit. So for example, there's no need for, you know, New York to go to Brooklyn and play a series. There's no need for Golden State to go to Sacramento and play a series, but maybe, as we have, there's a benefit when the Clippers have to go to Houston because that's a pretty long flight in the Western Conference. They're going to play two games. Well, guess what? We're going to save them a flight to Houston. They're going to play two games there, right? Similarly, you know, the Dallas going out to LA is another series on the schedule this year. So we focused on some of those longer travel opportunities to get the most bang for the buck. We'll look at the data after this year and decide whether we want to, you know, sort of push the pedal on that going forward.
So last season,
I was going to say the other point of that was last year, as we were doing this, the arenas were far more wide open than they are now. There's a lot more concert business that has come back. A lot of other additional events in our buildings that pretty much were very empty last year when we were trying to schedule these games. So we had a lot more flexibility. You know, we're going to see how this plays out now as we go forward.
So last season, it was almost more of out of necessity, doing what you guys could just to get the season scheduled and done in under unusual circumstances. This coming season, this is more like the pilot program, it sounds like. So this will be the test run for whether the business concerns that we would intuit would be there actually play out, right? So if this doesn't work out well, if attendance craters on the second night and ticket sales crater on the second night, then we're going to probably see the two-game series, I would think, scrapped or severely curtailed for the following year.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, we may find that it's matchup dependent, right? So if we have examples of two premier opponents playing a series with both games on television this coming year, we had that last year as well. So presumably you might see a little more, you know, attendance support for those types of matchups versus, you know, middle or lower tier opponents coming in. So we really want to get a sense of just what's the holistic impact, because really all we were able to measure last year is the basketball side of it. And frankly, we weren't even able to measure the player and team lifestyle side, if you will, because we had such restricted protocols in place that a team in a market for 3 days couldn't even leave the hotel for more than an hour a day at some parts of the season. And so that was overly restrictive, that made it more challenging to be in a city for 3 days for two games. So want to get a feel for it in a normal season. Great learning from last year that it may have legs. But yes, if this is our normal year, let's pilot test it. Let's see the holistic impact, and we'll reassess next summer how we want to move forward.
Yeah, so the jury is still out on that. You did not have to, in the broad sense, account for COVID this time in terms of the way you scheduled it. But of course, as we sit here in August, the Delta variant is spreading and COVID's still looming, and none of us know where things will be in late October when you guys get underway again. So two questions here. How much time did you spend thinking about how the pandemic might flare up and impact you again, whether it's about the schedule itself or whether teams might have to go fanless again or any of that? But also, it brings back in this other element, which is you did last season in two schedule dumps. You did one half at a time to give yourself the out in case there were postponements. As we go into this season, obviously there's the hope, and especially with more and more people being vaccinated, that it shouldn't be necessary. But I just wonder, was there any consideration given to breaking up the schedule again, doing it in two different releases, first half, second half, just in case the worst happens and we go back to lockdown, fanless games, whatever, or teams have a breakout or a COVID outbreak. Can't speak this morning.
We did consider that the two-stage schedule release, but decided for our own sanity, we needed those 10 months before we have to do another schedule, which was a small part of it. But to be serious, so we talked about it at length. Where we netted out was, in a world where you're anticipating significant number of postponements, a two-stage schedule release makes sense. We are now in a place that, Delta variant aside, we have a large majority of our players vaccinated. We played through modified protocols in summer league. We believe that this season will just look fundamentally different in terms of the restrictions on players, the likelihood of outbreaks, the need to postpone games. And so with the expectation that we're not going to have that many game postponements, there are a lot of downsides to the two-stage schedule release. The biggest one that we found that we just never knew because we hadn't done it was, it puts a ton of pressure on selecting which games go in the first half and the second half. And the reason for that is, if you think about a team's, take a West Coast team, a Pacific time zone team that is going to make a certain number of East Coast trips or trips to the Central time zone. Well, if you schedule too many of those in the first half or too few of those in the first half, you could be unduly impacting that team's second half schedule. And then when the postponements come, it puts that excess burden on that team to try to fit in. Well, they already were going to have a really tough travel pattern. Now we added in these postponed games. We had some teams, as I mentioned earlier, playing through some really, really difficult stretches in the second half because we couldn't perfectly split the travel, the back-to-backs, et cetera, across two halves, right? Because if you take the overall 82 game problem, now you're basically trying to solve it twice. You're trying to perfect it for one half and perfect it for the second half when the second half is so unknown. Throw in the national TV portion of this, which, we're trying to project out which teams deserve the national television appearances in the first half versus the second half. It just added complexity in a way that we thought was not a benefit to us unless we thought we were going to have many postponements, which we don't. And so we decided that the better path this year was to release a full schedule. Of course, we can always modify the schedule if necessary, as we did in the 1920 season, where we had to cut it short and go to the bubble. So we'll have opportunities to revisit if COVID takes us there. But I think we're a lot more optimistic than we were going into last season.
So no justifiably so, I think, I hope.
Sorry. The other piece, and Tom can touch on this, related to the arena, is arenas are booking fast. And so if we didn't release a second half schedule and had to ask teams to hold another 75 days, from January through April, I think we would have had a revolt on our hands as well. So it sort of served all parties in that sense.
I spoke to a team yesterday who said that, so we released the schedule Friday at 3:00, and the person who does the arena bookings for one of the teams said, at 3:05, I was looking to try and find the other dates that I could book shows into. So as soon as we release the dates that not only that we're using, that a team is playing on, but the dates that we're not using. So if there happens to be a Friday or Saturday in a market where they don't have a game, but they had held it because they didn't know what we were doing yet till we released our draft schedule and our final schedule, they go, well, wait a minute now. We've got a great chance to get this concert that was sort of on the back burner, but now, now we can get two nights of that show in there, and that's a big deal. And if you especially the arenas have gone through this shortage of events and thus shortage of revenue for the last 18 months. And so now, as soon as we released those dates, bang, they were out there trying to get shows. Now, on the other hand, in the last month of the process, or last 3 weeks of the process, there were two different tours that canceled dates in the spring. So we got some dates back. So this is a very, and one thing, the one thing we've learned is the flexibility that we have to have in this, at things that we would have said 2 years ago, well, we can't do that. We go, oh, okay, we'll change that. We'll rearrange this part of the schedule to make sure we get the games in and make sure we can finish our schedule and be competitively fair as much as we can.
How confident are you guys that the Toronto Raptors will be playing 41 home games in Toronto?
Better question for the Canadian government. I think as we understand it today, they're on a trajectory to be able to play their games at home. That's certainly the franchise's objective. And you know, they've been working closely with the government to make that a reality. But at this point, yes, we're confident. But there's, of course, many unknowns there.
Yeah. Are there contingencies for the Raptors? Are there contingencies in general due to COVID?
We did not build in any specific contingencies for the Raptors. And in fact, you know, had some discussions with them. The Tampa option ended up working quite well from a scheduling perspective last year. It becomes more of a challenge with an already released schedule if you were to try to move Raptors games to Tampa, because, for example, a team might have a back-to-back where they're supposed to play in, let's say, Milwaukee one night and Toronto the next. That gets materially harder if it's Milwaukee one night and Tampa the next. And so we weren't really able to build that flexibility in, but, you know, we did discuss with them what the timelines and things would look like. But other than that, no, we don't have any sort of fundamental contingencies other than what I mentioned, that we always have the ability to move things around as necessary. But we think we put out the best schedule we can given what we know now.
All right. So I've held back on this one because this is our annually most spicy topic. So let's jump into Christmas Day, shall we?
Sure.
My colleagues on the Open Floor podcast, Chris Herring and Michael Pina, had a field day dumping on you guys. Not by name. They weren't getting personal. But they were, aside from Nets Lakers, they were not sold on your schedule. So don't get mad at me. I'm just the messenger here. But I'm going to throw my colleagues under the bus. Here we go. Chris Herring of Celtics Bucks says, there's nothing Christmassy about it. They might as well be on different days. And he says that the league is really starved of rivalries, and maybe that's why we get Celtics Bucks. I, on the other hand, guys, I see two teams that wear a lot of green, and so to me it makes perfect sense you would put both of them on Christmas against each other. Pina also makes the note that the Hawks at Knicks is unfair because the Hawks were the better team and pretty much smoked the Knicks in the playoffs, but they're the ones who have to go on the road. Maybe because the Knicks play at the Garden. We'll get to that in a second. Of Mavs Jazz, Michael Pina said, this matchup is so random. There's no history here, no bad blood, no connection of any kind of drum-up intrigue. So the critiques is mostly about the idea that there have got to be more intriguing, spicy, compelling matchups. Those were not knocks on the quality of those teams. They're all good teams, but what is there to Jazz Mavs, for instance? So let's go. You guys fire away at Michael Pina and Chris Herring and how wrong they are. Give me a sense of how we got to that slate of five in particular.
Okay, so let's without taking anything personally, it's fine. we've got 10 teams to play on Christmas. And a lot of worthy candidates, right? So you're going to probably disappoint at least 10 and probably the other 10 as well of teams that don't get to play on Christmas. For example, Utah playing at home on Christmas, the team with the best record in the West last year, certainly deserves a chance to play on Christmas. Dallas's Luka Doncic is a very, exciting, intriguing player. So that seems like a good spot. Because we need to play five games at 12 noon, 2:30, 5 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and 10:30. So therefore, you've got to try and match up the buildings. You've got to try and match up time zones. And you've got to try and match up matchups that are going to be as compelling as you can possibly create when you're releasing the schedule in August. Milwaukee is the defending champions. It's sort of an unwritten traditional rule that the champs get to play at home on Christmas. So, okay, that's one venue. New York's been a great venue for us on Christmas. Historically, it's been terrific for us. The fact that the Hawks haven't played on Christmas since 1989 and played in New York was the last time they were on. It was a great little story, and Trae Young certainly, made his impression on playing in New York. So we think that one's a great matchup. You know, I'll defend them all. If we want to come up with alternatives, that's fine. But we don't do these in a vacuum. You know, we look at these very closely. We talk very much with our friends at the Walt Disney Company about the ABC games and the ESPN games, and they're really important to us. And the Brooklyn and Laker game, you know, at 8 o'clock Eastern is a terrific game. Now, you mentioned this earlier that, you know, do we pay attention to competition? Yeah, the NFL decided that they're going to play two games on Christmas. They're going to play the Green Bay Packers at 4:30, and they're going to play the Arizona Cardinals at 8 o'clock. And holy smokes, the Milwaukee Bucks and the Phoenix Suns were the two teams that played in the NBA Finals. And so in an effort to try and give them the attention that accomplishment deserves, you know, we juggled around a little bit. So Milwaukee's playing at 2:30 before the Packers play at 4:30 at home. The Phoenix Suns are playing at 5 o'clock against Golden State before the Arizona Cardinals play at home at 8 o'clock. So very cognizant of competition. Hopefully Klay Thompson will be back by Christmas, and that game gets even more attractive than it is right now. So I'm not personally, you know, we have plenty of people who complain about our matchups on Christmas, and certain ones of them. And as long as I've been doing this, both the overall schedule and working on the TV schedule, very rarely do we have unanimity of opinion that we were perfect on this. And that includes my son, who's complaining about, you know, how did you do this? But
I agree with all that. And I'll just add, I mean, in the 6 or 7 years that we've been doing this, I would say we are at a high point in terms of the number of teams that could make the case that they should be on Christmas Day, which is a great problem to have. I think in years past, you start to build a Christmas Day schedule and you fill in seven teams and you go, now what? who else is going to be on Christmas? And I think now we had a hard time. There's a handful of teams that, based on their performance last year, based on the star power of their players, are missing from the Christmas Day schedule. And in a normal year, you'd say, how did that happen? And the answer is, well, we got a lot of teams that have earned the right to be featured on those platforms. And if you want one of the missing teams to come in, you got to tell me who's going to come out, right? It's the same thing with, you know, people who make the top 10 list of players. If you say someone's missing, who are they replacing? And I think you start to question that. And then once you've got that set of 10 teams, as Tom said, I think our view is it's a little less about the matchup as featuring the teams and players who we know our fans want to see. So sure, there may not be a history or any rivalry with Dallas and Utah, but we know our fans like to tune in to see Luka Doncic. We know our fans like to tune in to see Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert. They had the best record in the league last year. Like, that is a game that's going to drive viewership in that 10:30 window, whether or not there's a rivalry or a history, to the Dallas Utah matchup. And so I think we have a great problem right now, which is an overweighting of teams who deserve that profile. And you know, that played itself out on the ABC schedule outside of Christmas. I think Tom, we set a record, at least under this current TV deal, for the number of teams featured on the ABC schedule over the course of the season, because we have so many high profile teams at the moment and high profile stars who we want to get out to the national audience.
No, I think that's right. I think that's objectively true. I mean, when we talk in the media about, you know, the races being a lot murkier this past postseason, or going into it, and even going into next season, like, we can all point to Lakers and Nets, and the odds makers certainly have, but I think we all understand, like, there's a pretty sizable group in both conferences that have a case to make, and that hasn't always been the case. So that speaks to the challenge you guys face for the scheduling Christmas. The other thing I thought about with the Christmas Day games, and maybe you can enlighten me on this part, the obvious thing would be, like, yeah, if there are teams with bad blood or their rivalries, or they played in the finals, they played in the conference finals, go ahead and match them back up. Or somebody got traded, match those guys up. And we go for the grudge matches and the drama, the personality conflicts. But it seems to me that with some of these teams, you're also maybe looking to promote, tell me if I'm wrong, certain teams or players that maybe haven't gotten as much national run recently. What is the balance between going for just the obvious, spicy matchup that everybody will immediately recognize. Oh yeah, I want to see those two teams play each other again because they hate each other or there was a trade, versus placing teams on Christmas that you want to boost by giving them that national platform that maybe hadn't had as much prominence.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you want to take the opportunity to use it to promote teams that may not have been in the national spotlight as much, maybe preceding last year's playoffs, right? So let's say a team like Atlanta. But Atlanta certainly played their way into getting onto Christmas by their performance throughout the playoffs last season. So they're a great example of that. I think the other thing is, as Evan said, you've got a lot of marquee players, the teams that fans want to see, and this gives us an opportunity to do that. And hopefully the two things come together. You're growing by putting those teams in there, and some of those teams are going to make it grow anyway.
You could also sort of question, like, there's the theoretical missing matchups, and then there's the practical, like to look at our league and say, well, there were a bunch of obvious matchups of teams that have bad blood that people want to tune in to see on Christmas Day. I'm not sure how long that list is, and I'm not sure what you'd be sacrificing to make it happen, right? So, for example, if you wanted a particular spicy matchup that featured either the Nets or the Lakers, well, then you can't have the Nets and Lakers play each other that day, which we know fans also want to see. So there's trade-offs, and Christmas Day isn't the only tentpole in our schedule. We have opening night where we've got Nets playing the Bucks and Warriors playing the Lakers in our play-in rematch. And so you've got lots of other opportunities to feature those same matchups. It doesn't have to be on Christmas Day. We have our ABC Saturday night temples. We have ABC Sundays. We have, TNT, obviously. So big games throughout the year. Christmas is just about maximizing eyeballs for the most viewed day in our calendar.
Yeah. All right. So bottom line is Michael Pena and Chris Herring were wrong about everything about the Christmas Day schedule. They don't know what they're talking about. They should apologize profusely, and they'll make up for it to you guys next year.
You said it, not us.
You said it, not us. It's their opinions, and they're very valid, and that's absolutely fine.
It was an entertaining discussion by them, I will say. People, go subscribe to the Open Floor podcast. Before I get to, I've got some questions from Twitter about the schedule, but I want to hit the play-in real quick because, Evan, you were on the pod a few months ago. We talked about this. The play-in tournament hadn't happened at that time yet, but you guys were happy about the effects that the existence of a play-in tournament had had on a level of competition down the stretch of the season. In other words, as an anti-tanking measure, it seemed to work well. And then you said the thing you were waiting for essentially was, let's see how the tournament itself turns out, both in terms of quality of the games, but also, of course, the ratings. As I understand it, play-in is renewed for this coming season, but just this coming season. It's not yet a permanent fixture. So how happy was the league with the actual execution of the play-in this past spring? And to the extent that it seems like you were happy enough to renew it at least one more year, where is the hesitancy? And I know this is a Board of Governors question, but where's the hesitancy, that, as you understand it, to make this just a permanent fixture?
Yeah, I mean, the games were pretty good, right? I think when you and I last spoke, we had to see how the games went, and I think had a couple blowouts in there, but all in all, really some of the biggest highlights of our season, and the viewership numbers matched. I think the Warriors Lakers did just short of 6 million viewers, which was only outdone by the Lakers Mavs last Christmas in terms of the entire season. Pre-playoff. So to generate that level of fan interest, that quality of competition, an opportunity for a team like Memphis to make it in despite being the ninth seed, build momentum, and have a really compelling first round series with Utah. All in all, I think our assessment was that it was a big win. And so we decided to continue it for this coming season. As to the question of why only one additional year, we don't know how this plays out in, again, a normal year. So much like the series, we knew what it did in a pandemic shortened season with a compressed schedule and a bunch of postponements and inequities across the schedule. We want to see how it does in a more normal schedule. And if it performs well, then I anticipate you could see it going forward. But for now, it's yet another thing that we want to pilot in a traditional season before making the long-term commitment.
Gotcha. And there are certainly some owners who have been vocal in their I would say opposition/misgivings, I guess. So
no one who wasn't in danger of falling into the 7 or 8 seed.
Also, fair to note, essential to note. All right, questions from Twitter. You guys probably have heard this ad nauseum in the last week, but in the wake of the Field of Dreams game, we had a lot of people saying, so when is the NBA going to do its version of this? And my buddy Michael Leaves over at ESPN even sent me the clip of he and L Duncan talking about this. L wanted to go with Knicks Nets at Rucker Park, and Michael Leaves, being the LA guy that he is or was at one time when I knew him back in the day, he went for Lakers Clippers at Venice Beach. Any possibility of anything like this happening? It seems like there are obviously a lot of potential obstacles, injury concerns on the blacktop, and I don't know how you create stands for the fans or what. It sounds amazing and also potentially fraught. Any talk of it?
I think the biggest concern is the basketball, and you highlight that you know, whether it's blacktop and injury concerns, or you know, a wooden court outside with humidity concerns and moisture that can get on the court, being beholden to rain, all of those things, you know, become a consideration. And we did play an outdoor preseason game a number of years ago, I believe, in Phoenix. So we've explored it, and we will continue to talk about it. Obviously, the Field of Dreams game was incredibly successful, so no surprise it has sparked some discussions, and it's worth exploring. But the logistical challenges of a basketball game outside are just significantly more than a baseball game, which of course is already outside. So we'll look at it. And as a fan, I'd love to see it. We'd have to figure out how to do it safely.
It would be insanely cool. I mean, like that part, everybody agrees on how you actually pull it off is another thing, but it would be insanely cool.
Yeah. We've discussed this over the years about playing in different venues. I was there when we played the game outdoors in Palm Springs with the Phoenix Suns. It was a preseason game, which was great, except by the fourth quarter, it was getting pretty daggone cold out there on the court, which is because it was wide open, obviously. So something really didn't anticipate the impact of. So I think that's something that we'd have to go back into and find the right place to play this. But that certainly, it's a great, you know, the National Hockey League's had great success playing their Winter Classic in their stadium series. So, you know, trying to figure out what could work for us as well.
If it's going to be, though, really authentic, one of the rims has to have some weird bend in it. And, you know, there have to be like no nets, or maybe the chain link nets. I look forward to the first time a game is lost because a gust of wind, you know, blew the ball off the rim as it was bouncing.
If we ever do our in-season tournament, then we can play the whole thing outside and modify the rules so that it doesn't affect, you know, the chase for Larry O'Brien. It can be an entirely new competition that's played outdoors, and we get that same opportunity to see our best playing on the blacktop.
The Rucker Cup. There we go.
Done.
I had multiple people, I assume they're all Clipper fans, complaining that the Clippers had four stints of five games in seven nights. I don't know what the gap between them and the next closest team is on five and seven, but
they have five and seven.
Five.
Your complainers were wrong. They have
five.
No.
worse. Why are you guys so mean to the Clippers? That's the question.
So they have five. There is another team with five. There is another team with four, and there are many teams with three. We are not mean to the Clippers. Five and sevens are just one of many, many metrics that one can use to evaluate the schedule. You know, we look at everything from the travel miles to the total number of back-to-backs, the no travel back-to-backs. So the Clippers, for example, play five no travel back-to-backs, meaning either home or in the same city, which is among the highest in the league. So we try to look at teams' schedules in totality. We have another metric we love, we've talked about in the past, called the fresh, tired, even metric, which is a measure of relative rest, right? Whether you are on the back-to-back or your opponent is. And so, yes, in any given metric, someone has to be the most and someone has to be the least. That's how ranges work. But we do make it fair across all these metrics, such that if someone is the highest in one metric, they're probably not going to be the highest in the others. And so, you know, Clippers and Portland actually are the two teams with five, five and sevens this year. That's just where the chips fell. But of course, back to the conversation earlier, that just means they're going to have more instances of 2 days off and 3 days off, because when you compress one portion of the schedule, that by definition means another portion is lighter. And so another team might say, wait a minute, I don't have any 2 day breaks, and say, fine, but you don't have any five and seven. So there's any number of ways that a fan or a team, you know, could raise concern. But our view is that it's really competitively fair across the whole board. And of course, everyone is playing 82 games between October 19th and April 10th. So on that basis, it's incredibly balanced.
Absolutely. I liked this question just because it was kind of a random one that didn't occur to me. But Adam Hammaker asked, do teams prefer 1 6-game trip or 2 3-gamers?
Team by team preference, I would say. I think Tom could kind of share from the 30 team tours we do. I would say the median preference for a road trip is 4 games. The teams say, I want to go out for 4 and home for 4 and vice versa. And so, we have most teams cap out at 6-game road trips. We have a few 7s and I believe 1 8-gamer, but that's the Spurs over their rodeo trip, which is split by All-Star. So most teams are capping out at that 6 and 7, and they would say that's a game or two too long. But again, that saves the trip home, especially in a long one. So really team by team though. And I've directly said to teams, would you prefer 2 3-gamers or a 6-gamer? And they kind of go, so it's, I don't think there's a clear answer to that.
It's usually based on where and when and who, where am I going? Who am I playing? And what part of the schedule is it? But I think 4 is kind of the number that we've been using as our guidepost.
You mentioned, Evan mentioned the Spurs. And one of the questions I got, this was from Trevor Zickgraff. He wondered about what input teams have into the building of the schedule, and specific to the Spurs, who have the rodeo trip, which I think you said was 8 games long, plus they have a separate 7-game trip. That's pretty brutal. So give me the background on that one.
So interesting backstory there. So you know our former colleague Hao Meng, who ran our optimizer, working with Tom and me for the last several years. Hao departed us last winter for the Spurs, where he now works in their basketball operations group. And so we actually work closely with Hao.
This would explain why I've not heard from Hao Meng in many months, yeah, because once you go behind the black and silver curtain there in San Antonio, you never hear from somebody again. Hao, if you're out there, I hope you're well. I look forward to maybe waving at you from across a crowded arena at some point. If we shake hands, you'll be banished from the Spurs kingdom. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so the rodeo trip's interesting because it spans All-Star, it looks on paper like an 8-game road trip. It's not. It's a 4 or 5-game trip before the break, then the break, and then another 3-game trip before they come home. So that one is sort of different than it looks on paper. Their earlier season road trip was actually a request, by the team not to be bouncing back and forth so much between the Northeast, where they were playing a number of games, and back to San Antonio, which is, a longer flight than some folks think. So that was actually catering to preference there. And it's a great way to save travel, right? To go up to the Northeast and play, I believe, Toronto, Boston, Philly, New York, Brooklyn, all in one little stretch there, knocks out a bunch of games in one region without requiring a lot of travel. So, you speak to team preferences. I think that was one that we worked with them, given their arena issues with rodeo, given their preferences on travel, to try to create something that would, be most fair to them and other teams.
I'll throw this one to Tom. This is his department, I believe. Jan Studebaker asked, and this was in a positive way, they were pleased to see this. Why did the ABC Sunday doubleheaders return?
It was an opportunity for us to get some more windows on ABC in the last weekend of the season. We don't have the Saturday night there. We lose a couple because of March Madness. So it was good. We're up to 19 games on ABC this year. So that's, again, a conversation between us and the Walt Disney Company about which games go on ABC and which games go on ESPN. And we thought it was best to try and do that. I think back to the, team preferences, we talk to all the teams a lot. We talk to all the teams and we ask them if they have specific preferences, especially because if there's anomalies in their schedule, whether it's the team that hosts the All-Star game, in this case, Cleveland, what to do around that. We ask teams if they want to submit priority dates, if there are certain dates that they want to play because of either a civic event in town that they want to be part of, or that they don't want to be part of because it's such a big civic event that they don't want to be playing there to be distracted from people's attention there. So we go through that, and I think we probably did the best we've ever done on following up on team requests and team priority requests and fulfilling them. So our guys did a great job on this. Pat Harrell, Gene Lee, and Matt Bressy on doing that and going through and keeping track of and making sure that we're cognizant of team requests and team priorities. and whether they're business or basketball or arena based, whatever it may come from.
That segues nicely to questions from two people on Twitter. Kale, not the crunchy leafy stuff that we love in Brooklyn. Asked, what kind of requests do teams make that influence the schedule? And then related to that from Chris McCabe, what is the strangest request?
Teams request a lot of things. Teams request some that are based on travel. So in other words, a team that is going to play is going to have Disney on Ice, for example, in their building at a certain point of the season. They're going to want to make sure they try and get a home game as close to the beginning and as close to the end of that period as possible, because they know they're going to be gone for, let's say, 7 to 10 days. That's one. Another one I mentioned, there's a couple of teams that are very big. The New Year's Eve is a very big deal in their market. Indianapolis, Oklahoma City, for example. And they want to be part of that. And they want to be part of the civic celebration there, so that they want to have a game in that window. Indiana requested to have a game on the weekend of the college football championship because the game's being played at Lucas Oil Stadium. And they thought that would be a great opportunity for them to get a game there that weekend. So we did that. Because you can look at it and say it's not going to be detrimental to anyone else. It's going to work. And that's the way we evaluate those. So that's a strange one. I'm going to have to think a little bit about that, about strange ones.
Any strange ones?
No, I mean, the atypical ones are when teams ask to play, you know, we sort of, as Tom alluded to, give teams priority dates, dates that they feel strongly they want to play at home for one reason or another. It's interesting because we have some teams who use those instead to say which dates they don't want to play at home, right? Either because, like in some cases, the ownership group of the team might have a charity event, and so they want to make sure that their team is off that night so that the players and staff of the team can participate in the charity event. We have some of those instances where the ownership event is in a city where the team doesn't play, and so that team may say, I want to, you know, team X wants to play in city Y on date Z to coincide with an event in that market. So we end up with some of those, which we can accommodate, just like we can accommodate the home priority, but it's always a little more odd when a team is asking to play somewhere else on a specific date. But nothing, I don't think we've gotten anything that's sort of too outside the realm of expectation that would pique interest of our fans.
I got a handful more if you guys have time.
Sure.
Okay. I assume this is from a Denver fan. Chris Process asks, if the Nuggets omission from the Christmas Day slate, obviously in the sense that, you know, the Nuggets obviously have the reigning regular season MVP and obviously a great team, is their omission from Christmas have anything to do with the weirdness of their whole TV arrangement?
No.
Okay.
No, they actually hosted Christmas the last 2 years, and they're featured in as one of the tentpole games on opening week on the first Wednesday on ESPN.
You know, and back to the conversation before about the good problem we have of a deep roster of teams. You know, you kind of look at get injuries and player availability, and you know, teams like the Clippers and the Nuggets not knowing whether we're going to have Kawhi Leonard or Jamal Murray available on Christmas Day, and you know, trying to place the best bets as to obviously Nikola Jokic is a huge star, he's our MVP, but trying to, you know, feature those best matchups and sort of player health plays a role in that as well based on what we know now.
I have one other team based grievance here from Twitter. But I actually think it's an interesting question because there's probably a really good explanation for this. And so now I'm curious. The Twitter handle was Knit, N-I-T, Twit, T-W-I-T, who asked, why do the Knicks have zero Saturday night games but 9 Wednesday games? Do you hate fun nights for Knicks fans?
And it's strictly based on their availability.
On arena availability.
Yeah. Yes. And we tried to, you know, we did the best we could to try and get some, but... it was just very difficult.
Yeah. No, I figured that was going to be like the most basic, boring, explanation that there could possibly be, because that's usually the answer on something as complicated as the schedule. But I thought maybe, you know, did the Knicks find that they weren't doing as well on Saturday nights or something, or that they wanted to have more Wednesdays for a reason? Like, I thought there could have been maybe something.
No, the number of Wednesdays certainly isn't a fluke. We have Wednesdays is one of our highest game count nights, and so we have many teams with probably 8 or 9 or 10 Wednesdays. The Knicks are a unique team that weekday games do incredibly well for them because The New York market, as you know, is a market of folks who are in the city during the week and coming to games on weeknights. And so, whereas some other teams may struggle with a Tuesday night 7 o'clock game, the Knicks do not. And so it's certainly not a focus to avoid weekend games, but it's less of an issue with their availability than it would be in some other places.
Apologies to the person who asked this question because I like the question, but I forgot to jot down their name on this one. But how do you determine same conference matchups where you're going against a team four times versus three? So the general guideline, of course, is that every team plays all the other teams in its own conference four times, teams in the other conference two times, but sometimes you have three instead of four. What's the determining factor there?
Yeah, it's just a matrix that rotates every 5 years, or over a five-year period. So in every five-year stretch, you play each team once three times with one of the games being at the one game instance being at home, once three times with one of the games being on the road, and then the other 3 years you play them the four times, and that just rotates every 5 years.
Last two here. My guy Lackey Everett, who I hear from a lot on Twitter, a very passionate NBA fan from overseas, asks if the schedule will ever cater to the international audience. I suspect that would be very difficult because it would mean shifting your game times to times that might not work so well in the home markets. But any way to somehow maximize the international market by shifting things around?
We do that. We've done that for the last number of years that we have what we call our international, primetime initiative, where we have teams playing Saturday afternoons, Eastern time, or to get into, let's call it 11 o'clock Western Europe, 11 p.m. Western Europe, to follow our big soccer matches in Europe. So we take a very, very careful look at that. And we work with our teams really closely to adjust the start time here and there, just specifically for that reason.
Yeah. So if you look at the Saturday schedules, essentially, almost every week you'll see a game at either 5 or 6 Eastern, right? So if it's an Eastern time zone game, it's 5 or 6. Of course, if it's out west, it would be a 2 or 3 local game. But really trying to target that consistent window in Europe, Middle East, and Africa to drive viewership there. Obviously, a little harder east you get. We've tried to do a primetime India schedule in the past where we play games at noon consistently. That becomes a challenge with some arena availabilities. And for years, we've looked at how to get games in primetime in China. But of course, that would require playing at 9 a.m., which becomes a player health concern. And we've found, in working with our China offices, that actually our morning window is a pretty good one because it's not competing with anything. And so a primetime game in the U.S. that's early morning in China can actually generate pretty significant viewership. And so we go market by market and try to find those opportunities. But yes, it is a challenge in some parts of the world.
I'm glad I asked that because I actually didn't realize that the Saturday afternoon schedule was reflective of an attempt to maximize the overseas market. So that was a good question.
And the teams have been really cooperative about doing that. We had to make a few last minute adjustments to try and get games in, but we really did. We really worked hard at that again this year.
Especially our teams with European stars who love the opportunity to feature those stars in their home markets. And so, you see a team with a star from Europe saying, like, I'd love to play at 5 p.m. and be on primetime over there.
Last one, and it's actually a very broad one. I could have started with this, actually, but it's a good question. So this is from Corey Brumbergs. He's asking that in your model, the algorithm, the model that you guys use to spit out the schedule with all the factors that you guys are punching in, he asks, what are you actually optimizing for? And is it basically just expected TV and ticket revenue? What else all goes into that? What are you optimizing for?
All of it. So we decided long ago, you can't optimize for any one thing, because just without getting into a math lesson here, the way linear optimization works is either you need to say, I'm trying to maximize this one thing subject to not violating all these constraints, right? But we don't have hard and fast constraints. It's not like we're saying we can't have a back-to-back or we can't have travel. Like, those things are a reality. And so you're trying to create a schedule that has the fewest number of back-to-backs and the fewest travel miles and the most opportunity for viewership and the most opportunity for gate and attendance. And those things are not zero sum. And so you can't write a traditional linear optimization code. So what you do is you do something called constraint-based optimization, where you assign a penalty value to each of those things. So every back-to-back in the schedule gets a penalty. Every incremental travel mile gets a penalty. Every opportunity, every time we don't feature a premier team on TV gets a penalty. Every time you don't satisfy a team's priority date, their home priority date, gets a penalty. And so you feed in what literally has grown over the last 7 years to about 1,000 or maybe even 1,500 individual constraints in the schedule, each one with its own relative penalty value, reflecting the relative importance of that, right? Maybe we say it's really, really important, meaning we're going to lock in that the Nets are playing the Lakers on Christmas Day. So give that the highest penalty value. Don't show me any schedules where that game's not there, because we want that game there. And then you run it through the system and say, go find the schedule that has the lowest aggregate penalty score. So what you're optimizing is that penalty score. And it's on us as the humans to say, what's the relative prioritization of those things? What penalty score do you assign? And that's where the art comes in, and that's where the challenge is. But schedule might come back and you're like, I like this element, but I might have set the penalty score too low over here, because look at this crazy travel pattern it created just to avoid some other outcome. And maybe you start to tweak the penalties and rerun it. But the answer is you're optimizing for this abstract penalty score that reflects all of the objectives, which is, again, over 1,000.
That was a great question. That was a really fascinating answer. I think I even understood most of that, Evan.
I told you, I didn't go into the math lesson.
That was about the max amount of math and logic I could tolerate probably before my head explodes. So it's always a good day when I can understand everything you're telling me.
I have the same thing.
Yeah. Guys, this has been great. I'm glad we could uphold our annual tradition, including the annual sub-tradition of struggling to schedule the schedulers for the pod. But we did it. We pulled it off. Tom Corelli, Evan Wash, thank you as always for making the time. Until next August, when we meet again, maybe even in person. This has been a blast. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much, Howard. You're welcome. Appreciate it.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Evan Wash and Tom Corelli. Thanks to NBA PR ace Jim LaBombard for his assistance. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all, as always, for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the Sports Illustrated Podcasts channel on YouTube, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.